This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents I Don't Know How She Does It by Alison Pearson, read by Josephine Bailey. Juggle. Verb and noun. Verb 1. Perform feats of dexterity, especially by tossing objects in the air and catching them, keeping several in the air at the same time. 2. Continue to deal with several activities at once, especially with ingenuity. 3. A. Deceive or cheat. B. Misrepresent facts. C. Rearrange adroitly. Noun 1. A piece of juggling. 2. A fraud. Concise Oxford Dictionary. Part 1. Chapter 1. Home. Monday, 1:37 a.m. How did I get here? Can someone please tell me that? Not in this kitchen, I mean in this life. It is the morning of the school carol concert, and I am hitting mince pies. No, let us be quite clear about this. I am distressing mince pies, an altogether more demanding and subtle process. Discarding the Sainsbury luxury packaging, I winkle the pies out of their pleated foil cups, place them on a chopping board, and bring down a rolling pin on their blameless, flowery faces. This is not as easy as it sounds, believe me. Hit the pies too hard, and they drop a kind of fat lady curtsy, skirts of pastry bulging out at the sides, and the fruit starts to ooze. But with a firm downward motion, imagine enough pressure to crush a small beetle, you can start a crumbly little landslide, giving the pastry a pleasing, homemade appearance. And homemade is what I'm after here. Home is where the heart is. Home is where the good mother is, baking for her children. All this trouble because of a letter Emily brought back from school 10 days ago, now stuck on the fridge with a tinky-winky magnet, asking if parents could please make a voluntary contribution of appropriate festive refreshments for the Christmas party they always put on after the carols. The note is printed in berry red, and at the bottom, next to Miss Empson's signature, there is a snowman wearing a mortarboard and a shy grin. But do not be deceived by the strenuous tone of informality or the outbreak of chummy exclamation marks. Oh, no. Notes from school are written in code, a code buried so cunningly in the text that it could only be deciphered at Bletchley Park or by guilty women in the advanced stages of sleep deprivation. Take that word parents, for example. When they write parents, what they really mean, what they still mean, is mothers. Has a father who has a wife on the premises ever read a note from school? Technically, it's not impossible, I suppose, but the note will have been a party invitation, and furthermore, it will have been an invitation to a party that has taken place at least 10 days earlier. And voluntary? Voluntary is teacher speak for on pain of death and or your child failing to gain a place at the senior school of your choice. As for appropriate festive refreshments, these are definitely not something bought by a lazy cheat in a supermarket. How do I know that? Because I still recall the look my own mother exchanged with Mrs. Frieda Davies in 1974, when a small boy in a dusty green parka approached the altar at Harvest Festival with 2 tins of Libby's Kling peaches in a shoebox. The look was unforgettable. It said, "What kind of sorry slattern has popped down to the spa on the corner to celebrate God's bounty when what the good Lord clearly requires is a fruit medley in a basket with cellophane wrap, or a plaited bread?" Frieda Davis's bread, manoeuvred the length of the church by her twins, was plaited as thickly as the tresses of a Rhine maiden. "You see, Catherine," Mrs. Davis explained later, doing that disapproving up-sneeze thing with her sinuses over tea cakes, "there are mothers who make an effort, like your mum and me, and then you get the type of person who," prolonged sniff, "don't make the effort." Of course I knew who they were. Women who cut corners. Even back in 1974, the dirty word had started to spread about mothers who went out to work. Females who wore trouser suits and even, it was alleged, allowed their children to watch television while it was still light. Rumours of neglect clung to these creatures like dust to their helmets. So before I was really old enough to understand what being a woman meant, I already understood that the world of women was divided in two. There were proper mothers, self-sacrificing bakers of apple pies and well-scrubbed invigilators of the washtub, and there were the other sort. At the age of 35, I know precisely which kind I am, and I suppose that's what I'm doing here in the small hours of the 13th of December, hitting mince pies with a rolling pin till they look like something mother made. Women used to have time to make mince pies and had to fake orgasms. Now we can manage the orgasms, but we have to fake the mince pies. And they call this progress. Damn, damn! Where has Paula hidden the sieve?
Kate,
what do you think you're doing? It's 2 o'clock in the morning. Richard is standing in the kitchen doorway, wincing at the light. Rich with his German street pyjamas, washed and tumbled to baby-grow bobbliness. Rich with his acres of English reasonableness and his fraying kindness. Slow Richard, my American colleague, Candy, calls him, because work at his ethical architecture firm has slowed almost to a standstill, and it takes him half an hour to take the bin out, and he's always telling me to slow down.
Slow down, Katie. You're like that funfair ride. What's it called? The one where the screaming people stick to the side so long as the damn thing keeps spinning?
Centrifugal force.
I know that. I mean, what's the ride called?
No idea. Wall of death?
Exactly.
I can see his point. I'm not so far gone that I can't grasp there has to be more to life than forging pastries at midnight. And tiredness. Deep-sea diver tiredness. Voyage to the bottom of fatigue tiredness. I've never really come up from it since Emily was born, to be honest. 5 years of walking round in a lead suit of sleeplessness. But what's the alternative? Go into school this afternoon and brazen it out, slam a box of Sainsbury's Finest down on the table of festive offerings. Then, to the mummy who's never there and the mummy who shouts, Emily can add the mummy who didn't make an effort. 20 years from now, when my daughter is arrested in the grounds of Buckingham Palace for attempting to kidnap the king, a criminal psychologist will appear on the news and say,
Friends trace the start of Emily Shattuck's mental problems to a school carol concert, where her mother, a shadowy presence in her life, humiliated her in front of her classmates.
Kate? Hello?
I need the sieve, Richard.
What for?
So I can cover the mince pies with icing sugar.
Why?
Because they are too evenly coloured, and everyone at school will know I haven't made them myself, that's why.
Richard blinked slowly, like Stan Laurel taking in another fine mess. Not why icing sugar, why cooking?
Katie, are you mad? You only got back from the States 3 hours ago. No one expects you to produce anything for the carol concert. Well, I expect me to.
The anger in my voice takes me by surprise, and I notice Richard flinch.
So where has Paula hidden the sodding sieve?
Rich looks older suddenly. The frown line, once an amused exclamation mark between my husband's eyebrows, has deepened and widened without my noticing into a 5-bar gate. My lovely, funny Richard, who once looked at me as Dennis Quaid looked at Ellen Barkin in The Big Easy, and now, 13 years into an equal, mutually supportive partnership, looks at me the way a smoking beagle looks at a medical researcher, aware that such experiments may need to be conducted for the sake of human progress, but still somehow pleading for release.
Don't shout, he sighs. You'll wake them.
One candy-striped arm gestures upstairs where our children are asleep. Anyway, Paula hasn't hidden it. You've got to stop blaming the nanny for everything, Kate. The sieve lives in the drawer next to the microwave.
No, it lives right here in this cupboard.
Not since 1997, it doesn't.
Are you implying that I haven't used my own sieve for 3 years?
Darling, to my certain knowledge, you have never met your sieve. Please come to bed. You have to be up in 5 hours.
Seeing Richard go upstairs, I long to follow him, but I can't leave the kitchen in this state. I just can't. The room bears signs of heavy fighting. There is Lego shrapnel over a wide area, and a couple of mutilated Barbies, one legless, one headless, are having some kind of picnic on our tartan travel rug, which is still matted with grass from its last outing on Primrose Hill in August. Over by the vegetable rack on the floor, there is a heap of raisins, which I'm sure was there the morning I left for the airport. Some things have altered in my absence. Half a dozen apples have been added to the big glass bowl on the pine table that sits next to the doors leading out to the garden, but no one has thought to discard the old fruit beneath, and the pears at the bottom have started weeping a sticky amber resin.
As I throw each pear in the bin, I shudder a little at the touch of rotten flesh. After washing and drying the bowl, I carefully wipe any stray amber goo off the apples and put them back. The whole operation takes maybe 7 minutes. Next, I start to swab the drifts of icing sugar off the stainless steel worktop, but the act of scouring releases an evil odor. I sniff the dishcloth. Slimy with bacteria, it has the sweet, sickening stench of dead flour water. Exactly how rancid would a dishcloth have to be before someone else in this house thought to throw it away? I ram the dishcloth in the overflowing bin and look under the sink for a new one. There is no new one. Of course there is no new one, Kate. You haven't been here to buy a new one. Retrieve old dishcloth from the bin and soak it in hot water with a dot of bleach. All I need to do now is put Emily's wings and halo out for the morning. I've just turned off the lights and am starting up the stairs when I have a bad thought. If Paula sees the Sainsbury's cartons in the bin, she will spread news of my great mince pie forgery on the nanny grapevine. Oh, hell. Retrieving the cartons from the bin, I wrap them inside yesterday's paper and carry the bundle at arm's length out through the front door. Looking right and left to make sure I am unobserved, I slip them into the big black sack in front of the house. Finally, with the evidence of my guilt disposed of, I follow my husband up to bed. Through the landing window and the December fog, a crescent moon is reclining in its deck chair over London. Even the moon gets to put its feet up once a month. Man in the moon, of course. If it was a woman in the moon, she'd never sit down. Well, would she? I take my time brushing my teeth. A count of 20 for each molar. If I stay in the bathroom long enough, Richard will fall asleep and will not try to have sex with me. If we don't have sex, I can skip a shower in the morning. If I skip the shower, I will have time to start on the emails that have built up while I've been away and maybe even get some presents bought on the way to work. Only 10 shopping days to Christmas, and I am in possession of precisely 9 gifts, which leaves 12 to get, plus stocking fillers for the children. And still no delivery from Quick Toy, the rapid online present service.
Kate, are you coming to bed?
Rich calls from the bedroom. His voice sounds slurry with sleep. Good.
I have something I need to talk to you about, Kate.
In a minute, I say. Just going to make sure they're okay. I climb the flight of stairs to the next landing. The carpet is so badly frayed up here that the lip of each step looks like the dead grass you find under a marquee 5 days after a wedding. Someone's going to have an accident one of these days. At the top, I catch my breath and silently curse these tall, thin London houses. Standing in the stillness outside the children's doors, I can hear their different styles of sleeping. His piglet snufflings, her princess sighs. When I can't sleep, and believe me, I would dream of sleep if my mind weren't too full of other stuff for dreams, I like to creep into Ben's room and sit on the blue chair and just watch him. My baby looks as though he has hurled himself at unconsciousness, like a very small man trying to leap aboard an accelerating bus. Tonight he sprawled the length of the cot on his front, arms extended, tiny fingers curled round an invisible pole. Nestled to his cheek is the disgusting kangaroo that he worships, a shelf full of the finest stuffed animals an anxious parent can buy. And what does he choose to love? A cross-eyed marsupial from Woolworth's remainder bin. Ben can't tell us when he's tired yet, so he simply says roo instead. He can't sleep without roo, because roo to him means sleep. It's the first time I've seen my son in 4 days. 4 days, 3 nights. First, there was the trip to Stockholm to spend some face time with a jumpy new client. Then Rod Task called from the office and told me to get my ass over to New York and hold the hand of an old client who needed reassuring that the new client wasn't taking up too much of my time. Benjamin never holds my absences against me. Too little still. He always greets me with helpless delight, like a fan windmilling arms at a Hollywood premiere. Not his sister, though. Emily is 5 years old and full of jealous wisdom. Mummy's return is always the cue for an intricate sequence of snubs and punishments.
Actually, Paula reads me that story. But I want Dada to give me a bath.
Wallace Simpson got a warmer welcome from the Queen Mother than I get from Emily after a business trip. but I bear it. My heart sort of pleats inside, and somehow I bear it. Maybe I think I deserve it. I leave Ben snoring softly and gently push the door of the other room. Bathed in the candied glow of her Cinderella light, my daughter is, as is her preference, naked as a newborn. Clothes, unless you count bridal or princess wear, are a constant irritation to her. When I pull the duvet up, her legs twitch in protest like a laboratory frog. Even when she was a baby, Emily couldn't stand being covered. I bought her one of those zip-up sleep bags, but she thrashed around in it and blew out her cheeks like the god of wind in the corner of old maps, till I had to admit defeat and gave it away. Even in sleep, when my girl's face has the furzy bloom of an apricot, you can see the determined jut to her chin. Her last school report said, "Emily is a very competitive little girl and will need to learn to lose more gracefully."
"Remind you of anyone, Kate?" said Richard, and let out that trodden puppy yelp he has developed lately.
There have been times over the past year when I have tried to explain to my daughter, I felt she was old enough to hear this, why Mummy has to go to work. Because Mum and Dad both need to earn money to pay for our house, and for all the things she enjoys doing, like ballet lessons and going on holiday. Because Mummy has a job she is good at, and it's really important for women to work as well as men. Each time the speech builds to a stirring climax, trumpets, choirs, the tearful sisterhood waving flags, in which I assure Emily that she will understand all this when she is a big girl and wants to do interesting things herself. Unfortunately, the case for equal opportunities, long established in liberal Western society, cuts no ice in the fundamentalist regime of the five-year-old. There is no God but Mummy, and Daddy is her prophet. In the morning, when I'm getting ready to leave the house, Emily asks the same question over and over until I want to hit her, and then, all the way to work, I want to cry for having wanted to hit her.
"Are you putting me to bed tonight? Is Mummy putting me to bed tonight? Are you? Who is putting me to bed tonight? Are you, Mum? Are you?"
Do you know how many ways there are of saying the word no without actually using the word no? I do. Must remember. Angel wings. Quote for new stair carpet. Take lasagna out of freezer for Saturday lunch. Buy kitchen roll, stainless steel special polish thingy, present and card for Harry's party. How old is Harry? 5? 6? Must get organized with a well-stocked present drawer like proper mother. Buy Christmas tree and stylish lights recommended in Telegraph. Selfridges or Habitat? Can't remember. Damn! Nanny's Christmas bribe slash present. Eurostar ticket? Cash? DKNY? Emily wants baby wee-wee doll over my dead body. Present for Richard. Wine tasting, Arsenal, pyjamas. In-laws book. The Lost Gardens of Somewhere. Ask Richard to collect dry cleaning. Office party, what to wear. Black velvet too small. Stop eating, now. Fishnets lilac, leg wax, no time, shave instead. Book stress-busting massage. Highlights, must book soonest. Starting to look like mid-period George Michael. Pelvic floor squeeze. Supplies of pill. Ice cake. Royal icing? Check Delia. Cranberries. Mini party sausages. Stamps for cards. Second class times 40. Present for E's teacher. And whatever you do, wean Ben off dummy before Christmas with in-laws. Chase Quick Toy. Useless mail order present company. Smear test MB. Wine. Gin. Vinsanto. Ring Mum. Where did I put Simon Hopkinson dry with hair dryer goose recipe? Stuffing? Hamster. Chapter 2. Work. 6:37 a.m.
Oh, come, let us adore him. Oh, come, let us adore him. Oh, come, let us adore him.
I am stroked, tugged, and when that doesn't work, finally Christmas Caroled Awake by Emily. She is standing by my side of the bed, and she wants to know where her present is. "You can't buy their love," says my mother-in-law, who obviously never threw enough cash at the problem. I did once try to come home empty-handed from a business trip, but on the way back from Heathrow I lost my nerve and got the cab to stop at Hounslow, where I dived into a Toys R Us, adding a toxic shimmer to my jet lag. Emily's global Barbie collection is now so sensationally slutty it can only be a matter of time before it becomes a Jeff Koons exhibit. Flamenco Barbie, AC Milan Barbie, soccer strip, dinky boots, Thai Barbie, a flexible little minx who can bend over backwards and suck her own toes, and the one that Richard calls Klaus Barbie, a terrifying uber-blonde with sightless blue eyes in jodhpurs and black boots.
"Mummy,"
says Emily, weighing up her latest gift with a connoisseur's eye.
"This fairy Barbie could wave a wand and make the little baby Jesus not be cross."
"Barbie isn't in the baby Jesus story, Emily." She shoots me her best Hillary Clinton look, full of noble, "this pains me more than you" condescension.
"Not that baby Jesus,"
she sighs.
"Another one, silly."
You see, what you can buy from a 5-year-old when you get back from a client visit is, if not love or even forgiveness, then an amnesty of sorts. Entire minutes when the need to blame is briefly overcome by the need to rip open a package in a tantrum of glee. Any working mother who says she doesn't bribe her kids can add liar to her CV. Emily now has a gift to mark each occasion of her mother's infidelity, playing away with her career, just as my mum got a new charm for her bracelet every time my father played away with other women. By the time Dad walked out when I was 13, Mum could barely lift the golden handcuff on her wrist. I'm lying here thinking things could be a lot worse. At least my husband is not an alcoholic serial adulterer, when Ben toddles into the bedroom, and I can hardly believe what I'm seeing. "Oh, God, Richard! What's happened to his hair?" Rich peers over the top of the duvet, as though noticing his son, who will be one in January, for the first time.
"Ah, Paula took him to that place by the garage. Said it was getting in his eyes."
"He looks like something out of the Hitler Youth."
"Well, it will grow back, obviously. And Paula thought, and I thought too, obviously, that the whole Fauntleroy ringlet thing, well, it's not how kids look these days, is it?"
"He's not a kid. He's my baby. And it's how I want him to look. Like a baby." Lately, I notice Rich has adopted a standard procedure for dealing with my rages. A sort of bowed head in the event of nuclear attack, submissive posture. But this morning he can't suppress a mutinous murmur.
"Don't think we could arrange an international conference call with the hairdresser at short notice."
"And what's that supposed to mean?"
"It just means you've got to learn to let go, Kate."
And with one practiced movement, he scoops up the baby, swipes the gangrenous snot from his tiny nose, and heads downstairs for breakfast. 7:15 a.m. The change of gears between work and home is so abrupt sometimes that I swear I can hear the crunch of mesh in my brain. It takes a while to get back onto the children's wavelength. Brimming with good intentions, I start off in Julie Andrews mode, all tennis club enthusiasm and mad sing-song emphases. "Now, children, what would you like for breakfast today?" Emily and Ben humour this kindly stranger for a while, until Ben can take no more of it and stands up in his high chair, reaches out, and pinches my arm as though to make sure it's me. Their relief is plain as, over the next frazzled half hour, the ratty bag they know as Mummy comes back. "You're having Shreddies and that's it. No, we haven't got Fruity Bix. I don't care what Daddy let you have." Richard has to leave early, a site visit with a client in Battersea. Can I do the handover with Paula? Yes, but only if I can leave at 7:45 on the dot. 7:57 a.m. And here she comes, flourishing the multiple excuses of the truly unapologetic. The traffic, the rain, the alignment of the stars. "You know how it is, Kate." "Indeed, I do." I cluck and sigh in the designated sympathy pauses while my nanny makes herself a cup of coffee and flicks without interest through my paper. Pointing out that in the 26 months Paula has been our children's carer, she has managed to be late every fourth morning would be to risk a row, and a row would contaminate the air that my children breathe. So no, there won't be a row. Not today. 3 minutes to get to the bus, 8 minutes walk away. 8:27 a.m. I am going to be late for work. Indecently, intrepidly late. Bus lane is full of buses. Abandoned bus. make lung-scorching sprint down City Road and then cut across Finsbury Square, where my heels skewer into the forbidden grass and I attract the customary loud "Oi!" from the old guy whose job it is to shout at you for running across the grass.
"Oi, miss, can't you go round the outside like everyone else?"
Being shouted at is embarrassing, but I am beginning to worry that a small, shameful part of me really likes being called miss in a public place. At the age of 35, and with gravity and two small children dragging you down, you have to take your compliments where you can. Besides, I reckon the shortcut saves me maybe 2.5 minutes. 8:47 a.m. One of the city's oldest and most distinguished institutions, Edwin Morgan Forster, stands at the corner of Broadgate and St. Anthony's Lane, a 19th-century fortress with a great jutting prow of 20th-century glass. It looks as though a liner has crashed into a department store and come out the other side. Approaching the main entrance, I slow to a trot and run through my kit inspection. Shoes, matching, two of, check. No baby sick on jacket, check. Skirt not tucked into knickers, check. Bra not visible, check. Okay, I'm going in. Stride briskly across the marble atrium and flash my pass at Gerald in security. Since the revamp 18 months ago, the lobby of Edwin Morgan Forster, which used to look like a bank, now resembles one of those zoo enclosures designed by Russian constructivists to house penguins. Every surface is an eyeball-shattering Arctic white, except the back wall, which is painted the exact turquoise of the Yardley gift soap favoured by my great-aunt Phyllis 30 years ago, but which was described by the designer as an ocean-going colour of vision and futurity. For this piece of wisdom, a firm which is paid to manage other people's money handed over an unconfirmed $750,000. Can you believe this building? 17 floors served by 4 lifts. Divide by 430 employees. Factor in 6 button-pushing ditherers, 2 mean bastards who won't hold the door, and Rosa Klebb with the sandwich trolley, and you either have a possible 4-minute wait or take the stairs. I take the stairs. Arrive on floor 13 with fuchsia face and walk straight into Robin Cooper Clark, our pinstriped director of investment. The clash of odours is as immediate as it is pungent. Me, eau de sweat, him, florist elite, with undernotes of Winchester and walnut dashboard. Robin is exceptionally tall, and it is one of his gifts that he manages to look down at you without actually looking down on you, without making you feel in any way small. It came as no surprise to learn in an obituary last year that his father was a bishop with a military cross. Robin has something both saintly and indestructible about him. There have been times at EMF when I have thought I would die if it weren't for his kindness and lightly mocking respect.
"Remarkable colour, Kate. Been skiing?"
Robin's mouth is twitching up at the corners and on its way to a smile, but one bushy grey eyebrow arches incredulously towards the clock above the dealing desk. Can I risk pretending that I've been in since 7 and just slipped out for a cappuccino? A glance across the office tells me that my assistant, Guy, is already smirking purposefully by the water cooler. Damn. Guy must have spotted me at exactly the same moment because across the bowed heads of the traders, phones cradled under their chins, over the secretaries and the European desk and the global equities team in their identical purple Lewin shirts, comes the calling all superiors voice of my assistant.
"I've put the document from Bengt Berman on your desk, Catherine," he announces. "Sorry to see you've had problems getting in again."
Notice the use of the word again, the drop of poison on the tip of the dagger. Little creep. When we funded Guy Chase through the European Business School 3 years ago, he was a Balliol brain ache with a 4-piece suit and a personal hygiene deficit. He came back wearing charcoal Armani and the expression of someone with a master's in blind ambition. I think I can honestly say that Guy is the only man at Edwin Morgan Forster who likes the fact that I have kids. Chicken pox, summer holidays, carol concerts, all are opportunities for Guy to shine in my absence. I can see Robin Cooper Clark looking at me expectantly now. Think, Kate, think. It is possible to get away with being late in the city. The key thing is to offer what my lawyer friend Deborah calls a man's excuse. Senior managers who would frankly be appalled by the story of a vomiting nocturnal baby or an AWOL nanny, mysteriously childcare, though paid for by both parents, is always deemed to be the female's responsibility, are happy to accept anything to do with the internal combustion engine. The car broke down slash was broken into. You should have seen the fill-in scene of mayhem at fill-in street. Either of these will do very well. Car alarms have been a valuable recent addition to the repertoire of male excuses because, although displaying female symptoms, hair trigger unpredictability, high-pitched shrieking, they are attached to a man's excuse and can be taken to a garage to be fixed. You should have seen the mess at Dalston Junction, I tell Robin, composing my features into a mask of stoic urban resignation and, with outstretched arms, indicating a whole vista of car carnage. Some maniac in a white van. Traffic lights out of sync. Unbelievable. Must have been stuck there, 20 minutes. He nods.
London driving almost makes one grateful for Network Southeast.
There is a heartbeat of a pause in which I try to ask about the health of Jill Cooper Clark, who was diagnosed with breast cancer in the summer. But Robin is one of those Englishmen equipped from birth with an early warning system which helps them to intercept and deflect any incoming questions of a personal nature. So even as my lips are forming his wife's name, he says,
I'll get Christine to book a lunch for us, Kate. You know they've converted some cellar by the Old Bailey. Serving up lightly grilled witness, no doubt. Sounds amusing, don't you think?
Yes, I was just wondering how...
Splendid. Talk later.
By the time I reach the haven of my desk, I've regained my composure. Here's the thing. I love my job. It may not always sound like it, but I do. I love the blood rush when the stocks I took a punt on deliver the goods. I get a kick out of being one of the handful of women in the club lounge at the airport, and, when I get back, I love sharing my travel horror stories with friends. I love the hotels with room service that appears like a genie and the prairies of white cotton that give me the sleep I crave. When I was younger, I wanted to go to bed with other people. Now that I have two children, my fiercest desire is to go to bed with myself for a whole 12 hours. Most of all, I love the work, the synapse-snapping satisfaction of being good at it, of being in control when the rest of life seems such an awful mess. I love the fact that the numbers do what I say and never ask why. 9:03 a.m. Switch on my computer and wait for it to connect. The network is so slow this morning, it will be quicker to fly to Hong Kong and pick up the Hang Bloody Seng in person. Type in my password, Ben Pampers, and go straight into Bloomberg to see what the markets have been up to overnight. The Nikkei is steady. Brazil's Bovespa is doing its usual crazy samba, while the Dow Jones looks like the printout on a do-not-resuscitate patient in intensive care. Baby, it's cold outside, and not just on account of the fog nuzzling the office blocks outside my window. Next, I check currencies for any dramatic movements, then type in TOP to call up all the big corporate news stories. The main one is about Gail Fender, a bond trader, or rather an ex-trader. She's suing her firm, Lawrence Austin, for sex discrimination because male colleagues got far bigger bonuses than she did for less good results. The headline reads, Ice Maiden Cools Towards Men. As far as the media is concerned, city women are all either Elizabeth I or a resting lap dancer. That old virgin and whore thing wrapped up in the Wall Street Journal. Personally, I've always fancied the idea of becoming an ice maiden. Maybe you can buy the outfit? Trimmed in white fur, stalactite heels with matching pickaxe. Anyway, Gail Fender's story will end how those stories always end, with a no comment, as, eyes lowered, she leaves the courtroom by a side door. This city smothers dissent. We have ways of making you not talk. Stuffing people's mouths with 50-pound notes tends to do the trick. Click on emails. 49 arrivals in my inbox since I left on Thursday. Skim down them, sorting out the junk first. Free trial of a new investment magazine? Trash. You are invited to a conference on globalization on the shores of Lake Geneva, catered by the world-famous chef Jean-Louis Trash. Human Resources wants to know if I will appear in the new EMF corporate video. Only if I get my own trailer with John Cusack tied to the bed. Will I sign a card for some poor bugger in Treasury who's been made redundant? Jeff Brooks is going voluntarily, they say, but the compulsories will start soon. Yes. The message at the very top of the inbox is from Celia Harmsworth, head of Human Resources. It says that my boss, Rod Task, has had to pull out of the induction talk for EMF's trainees this lunchtime, and could I please step in? We would be very glad to see you in the 13th floor conference room from 1 p.m. No, no, no. I have 9 fund reports to write by Friday. Plus, I have a very important nativity play to attend at 2:30 this afternoon. With work memos out of the way, I can get to the real emails, the ones that matter. Messages from friends, jokes and stories handed around the world like sweets. If it's really true what they say, that mine is the time-famished generation, then email is our guilty snack, our comfort food. It would be hard to explain how much sustenance I get from my regular correspondence. There's Deborah, my best friend from college, now mother of 2 and a lawyer with Addison Pope, just across the way from the Bank of England, and about 10 minutes' walk from Edwin Morgan Forster. Not that I ever get down there to see her. Might as well work on Pluto. And then there's Candy, foul-mouthed fellow fund manager, worldwide web whiz, and proud export of Rockaway, New Jersey, Candice Marlene Stratton, my sister-in-arms, and a woman in the vanguard of the latest developments in world corsetry. My favourite character in literature is Rosalind in As You Like It. Candy's favourite character in literature is the guy in Elmore Leonard who wears a T-shirt that says, "You've obviously mistaken me for someone who gives a shit." Candy sits right over there, next to the pillar, 15 feet away, and yet we scarcely exchange more than a few words out loud during an average day. On screen, though, we're in and out of each other's minds like old-fashioned neighbours. To Kate Reddy, EMF, from Candy Stratton. Kate, question. Why are married women heavier than single women? Answer. Single women come home, see what's in the fridge, and go to bed. Married women come home, see what's in the bed, and go to the fridge. How you? Me, cystitis. Too much sex. Kisses. To Kate Reddy, EMF, from Deborah Richardson, Addison Pope. Morning. How was Sweden and New York City? Poor you. Felix fell off table and broke his arm in 4 places. Didn't think there were 4 places to break. Nightmare. Spent 6 hours in casualty. Good old NHS. Ruby announced yesterday that she loves her nanny, her daddy, her rabbit, her brother, all the Teletubbies and her mummy, in that order. Nice to know it's all worthwhile, no? Remember lunch on Friday? Tell me you're not cancelling. Deb. Kisses. To Candy Stratton, from Kate Reddy. Another relaxing few days. Stockholm, New York, Hackney. Up till dawn forging mince pies for Emily's carol concert. Don't even ask. Plus, Pol Pot has given Ben a hideous Nazi haircut, and I daren't complain because I was away, and being away means you surrender all rights to maternal authority. Plus, I have to remind Rod Taskmaster that I need to leave early today for the concert. Any suggestions how to do this without mentioning the words A, child, or B, leave? Love, Kate. Kisses. P.S. What is sex? Rings vague bell. To Kate Reddy, from Candy Stratton. Hun, you gotta cut domestic goddess crap. Look other moms in the eye and say, "I'm busy and I'm proud," or you will be dead. Tell Rod Task you have major menstruation situation. Aussie's even more freaked by women's trouble than Brits. See you later. Kisses. I glance across the office and see Candy swigging from a can, which she hoists aloft in a cheery toast to me. Until recently, Candy's diet was confined to Coke, the diet kind and the other kind, which left her pencil thin with prominent breasts. This got her plenty of lovers, but not a lot of love. A year older than me, at 36, Candy is congenitally single, and sometimes I envy her ability to do the most fantastic things, like going to have a drink after work, or visiting the bathroom at weekends unaccompanied by a curious 5-year-old, or coming into work hollow-eyed after being up all night having sex, instead of coming into work hollow-eyed after being up all night with the wailing product of sex. Candy did get engaged a couple of years back to a consultant from Anderson's. Unfortunately, she was so busy working on a final for a German pension fund that she stood him up 3 dates in a row. The third time, Bill was waiting for her in a restaurant at Smithfield, and he got talking to a nurse from St. Bart's at the next table. They were married in August. Candy says she's not going to worry about her fertility, though, until Cartier starts making a biological clock. To Deborah Richardson, Addison Pope, from Kate Reddy, EMF. Dear Dee, so late in this AM, can't write much now. No way am I cancelling lunch. Why is truthful woman's excuse always less acceptable than man's false excuse? Puzzled, Kate. To Kate Reddy, from Deborah Richardson. Because they don't want to be reminded that you have a life, stupid. See you Friday, D. Kisses. I decided not to approach Rod Task in person over the question of leaving work early to get to Emily's nativity play. Better to tag it on casually as a PS to some work email. Make it look like a fact of life, not a favour. Just got a reply. To Kate Reddy, from Rod Task.
Jesus, Katie! Only seems like yesterday you had your own nativity. Sure, take the time you need, but we should talk around 5:30. And I need you to go to Stockholm to hold Sven's hand again. Is Friday good for you, Butte? Cheers, Rod.
No, Friday is not good for me. I can't believe he expects me to do another trip before Christmas. Means I will miss the office party, have to cancel lunch with Deborah again, and lose the shopping time I was counting on. Our office is open plan, but the director of marketing has one of 2 rooms with walls. The other belongs to Robin Cooper Clark. When I march in to Rod to make my protest, the office is empty, but I stay a few moments anyway to take in the view through the floor-to-ceiling window. Directly below is the Broadgate rink, a dinner plate of ice set in the middle of staggered towers of concrete and steel. At this hour it's empty, save for a lone skater, a tall, dark guy in a green sweatshirt, carving out what at first I think are figures of 8, but as he makes the long downward stroke, realizes a large dollar sign. With the fog unfurling, the city looks as it did during the Blitz, when smoke from the fires dispersed, magically revealing the dome of St. Paul's. Turn in the opposite direction, and you see the Canary Wharf Tower winking like a randy cyclops. Coming out of Rod's room, I run smack into Celia Harmsworth, although no injury is done to either party because I simply bounce off Celia's stupendous bust. When English women of a certain background reach the age of 50, they no longer have breasts. They have a bosom, or even, depending on acreage of land and antiquity of lineage, a bust. Breasts come in 2s, but a bust is always singular. The pliant pair meld into a fiberglass monopod, sloping gently downward like a continental shelf. The bust denies the possibility of cleavage or any kind of jiggling. Where breasts say, come and play, the bust, like the snub nose of a bumper car, says, out of my way. The Queen has a bust, and so does Celia Harmsworth.
Catherine Reddy, always in such a hurry, she scolds.
As head of human resources, Celia is effortlessly one of the least human people in the building. Childless, charmless, chilly as Chablis, she has this knack of making you feel both useless and used. When I went back to work after Emily was born, I found out that Chris Bunce, hedge fund manager and EMF's biggest earner for the past 2 years, had put a shot of vodka in the expressed breast milk I was storing in the office fridge next to the lifts. I approached Celia and asked her, woman to woman, what course of action she suggested taking against a jerk who, when confronted by me in Davy's bar, claimed that putting alcohol into the food intended for a 9-week-old baby was having a bit of a laugh. I can still remember the moo of distaste on Celia's face, and it wasn't for that bastard Bunce.
Use your feminine wiles, dear, she said.
Celia tells me she is delighted that I can talk to the trainees at lunchtime.
Rod said you could do the presentation in your sleep. Just slides and a few sandwiches. You know the drill, Kate. And don't forget the mission statement, will you?
I make a quick calculation. If the induction lasts an hour, including drinks, say, that will leave me 30 minutes to find a cab and get across the city to Emily's school for the start of the nativity play. Should be enough time. I can make it so long as they don't ask any damn questions. 1:01 p.m. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Kate Reddy, and I'd like to welcome you all to the 13th floor. 13 is unlucky for some, but not here at Edwin Morgan Forster, which ranks in the top 10 money managers in the UK and in the top 50 globally in terms of assets, and which, for 5 years running, has been voted Money Manager of the Year. Last year we generated revenue in excess of £300 million, which explains why absolutely no expense has been spared on the fabulous tuna sandwiches you see spread out before you today. Rod's right. I can do this sort of stuff in my sleep. In fact, I pretty much am doing it in my sleep, as the jet lag takes hold and the crown of my skull starts to tighten and my legs feel as though someone is filling them with iced water. You will, I am sure, already be familiar with the term fund manager. Put at its simplest, a fund manager is a high-class gambler. My job is to study the form of companies round the world, assess the going rate in the markets for their products, check out the track record of jockeys, stick a big chunk of money on the best bet, and then hope to hell that they don't fall at the first fence. There is laughter around the room, the overgrateful laughter of 20-somethings, caught between arrogance at securing one of only 6 EMF traineeships and wetting themselves at the thought of being found out. If the horses I've backed do fall, I have to decide whether we shoot them right away or whether it's worth nursing that broken leg back to health. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, compassion can be expensive, but it's not necessarily a waste of your money. I was a trainee myself 12 years ago, sitting in a room just like this one, crossing and uncrossing my legs, unsure whether it was worse to look like the Duchess of Kent or Sharon Stone. The only woman recruit in my year, I was surrounded by guys, big animal guys at ease in their pinstriped pelts. Not like me. The black crepe whistle suit I had spent my last 40 quid on made me look like a Wolverhampton schools inspector. This year's bunch of novices is pretty typical. 4 guys, 2 girls. The guys always slouch at the back. The girls sit upright in the front row, pens poised to take notes they will never need. You get to know the types after a while. Look at Mr. Anarchist over there, with the Velcro sideburns and the Liam Gallagher scowl. In a suit today, but mentally still wearing a leather jacket, Dave was probably some kind of student activist at college. He read economics the better to arm himself for the workers' struggle, while morally blackmailing all the kids on his corridor into buying that undrinkable Rwandan coffee. Right now, he's sitting there telling himself he's just going to do this city shit for 2 years. 5 tops. Get some serious dough behind him, then launch his humanitarian crusade. I almost feel sorry for him. 7 years down the line, living in some modernist mausoleum in Notting Hill, school fees for 2 kids, wife with a ruinous Jimmy Choo habit, Dave will be nodding off in front of friends like the rest of us, with a copy of The New Statesman unopened in his lap. The other guys are pink-gilled landed types, with prep school partings. The one called Julian has an Adam's apple so overactive it's practically making cider. As usual, the girls are unmistakably women, whereas the men are barely more than boys. Between them, EMF's 2 female trainees cover the spectrum of womanhood. One is a doughy Shires girl with a kindly bun face and a velvet headband, the daytime tiara of her class. Clarissa somebody. Glance down the list of potted biographies and see that Clarissa is a graduate in modern studies from the University of Peterborough. Pure back-office material. Must be a niece of one of the directors. You don't get into EMF with a degree like that unless you are a blood relative of money. The girl next to her looks more interesting. Born and brought up in Sri Lanka, but educated at Cheltenham Ladies and the London School of Economics, one of those granddaughters of empire who end up more English than the English. The sweetness of their courtesy, the decorum of their grammar. With cat-like composure and remarkable leaf-shaped eyes that gaze steadily out through tortoiseshell specks. Momo Gumaranthi is so pretty she should only enter the square mile with an armed guard. The trainees return my appraising stare. I wonder what they see. Blondish hair, decent legs, in good enough shape not to be pinned for a mother. They wouldn't guess I was northern either. Accent ironed out when I came to study down south. They may even be a little scared of me. The other day, Rich said I frightened him sometimes. Now, I'm sure everyone here will have seen that line they put in tiny bottom row of the optician's chart print on your bank and building society accounts. Remember that the value of your investment can go down as well as up? Yes? Well, that's me. If I pick 'em wrong, the value goes down. So at EMF, we do our very best to ensure that doesn't happen, and most of the time we succeed. I find it useful to bear in mind when I'm selling $3 million of airline stock, as I did this morning, that ours is the only flutter in the world which can leave a little old lady in Dumbarton without a pension. But don't worry, Julian, trainees are limited in the size of the deal they can make. We'll give you $50,000 for starters, just to get some practice. Julian's cheeks flush from smoked trout to strawberry, and the doughy girl's hand shoots up.
Can you tell me why you sold that particular stock today?
That's a very good question, Clarissa. Well, I had a $4 million holding, and the price was up and was continuing to rise. But we'd made a lot of money already, and I knew from reading the trade papers that there was bad news coming about airlines. The job of fund manager is to get our clients' money out before the price weakens. All the time, I'm trying to balance the good things that might happen against the act of an almighty pissed-off God that may be lurking just around the corner. In my experience, the biggest test for any Edwin Morgan Forster trainee is not the ability to grasp the essentials of investment or to secure a pass for the car park. No, the thing that shows what you're really made of is if you can keep a straight face the first time you hear the firm's mission statement. Known internally as the Five Pillars of Wisdom, the mission statement is the primest corporate baloney. By what freak of logic did hardcore capitalists of the late 20th century end up parroting slogans first chanted by Maoist peasants who were not even permitted to own their own bicycles? Our five pillars of wisdom are 1. Pulling together. 2. Mutual honesty. 3. Best results. 4. Client care. And 5. Commitment to success. I can see Dave struggling manfully to suppress a smirk. Good boy. Glance up at the clock. Shit! Time to go. Now, if there are no more questions... Damn! The other girl has her hand up now. At least you can rely on the men not to ask a question, even when they don't know anything, like this lot, and especially not of someone at my level, when asking a question means admitting that there are still things in the world that are beyond you. I'm so sorry, the young Sri Lankan begins, as though apologizing for some error she has yet to commit. I know that EMF has, well, as a woman, Miss Reddy, can you tell me honestly, how do you find working in this job? Well, Miss Momo Gumaratni. Well, Momo, there are 60 fund managers here, and only 3 of us are women. EMF does have an equal opportunities policy, and as long as trainees like you keep coming through, we're going to make that happen in practice. Secondly, I understand that the Japanese are working on a tank where you can grow babies outside the womb. They should have that perfected by the time you're ready to have children, Miss Gumaratni, so we really will be able to have the first lunch hour baby. Believe me, that would make everyone at Edwin Morgan Forster very happy. I assume that will stop the questions dead. But Momo is not as mousy as I thought. Her coffee skin suffused with a blush, she puts up her hand again. As I turn to pick up my bag, indicating that the session is over, she starts to speak.
I'm really sorry, Miss Reddy, but may I ask if you have children of your own?
No, she can't. Yes, the last time I looked there were 2 of them. And may I suggest, Miss Gumaratni, that you don't start your sentences with, I'm sorry. There are a lot of words you'll find useful in this building, but sorry isn't one of them. Now, if that's all, I really must go and check the markets. Winners to pick, money to manage. Thank you for your attention, ladies and gentlemen, and please do come up if you see me round the building, and I'll test you on our 5 pillars of wisdom. If you're really lucky, I'll give you my personal pillar, number 6. They look at me dumbly. Pillar number 6. If money responds to your touch, then there's no limit to what a woman can achieve in this city. Money doesn't know what sex you are. 2:17 p.m. You can always pick up a cab from the rank outside Warburg's. Any day except today. Today, the cabbies are all at some dedicated Make Kate Late rally. After 7 minutes of not being hysterical at the curbside, I hurl myself in front of a taxi with its light off. The driver swerves to avoid me. I tell him I'll double the fare on the clock if he takes me to Emily's school without using his brakes. Lurching around in the back as we weave through the narrow, choked streets, I can feel the pulse points in my neck and wrist jumping like crickets. 2:49 p.m. The woodblock floor in Emily's school hall was obviously installed with the express purpose of exposing late-arriving working mothers in heels. I tick-tock in at the moment when Angel Gabriel is breaking the big news to the Virgin Mary, who starts pulling the wool off the donkey sitting next to her. Mary is played by Genevieve Law, daughter of Alexandra Law, form representative and a mother superior. In other words, defiantly non-working. There is serious competition among the mothers superior to secure leading roles in the production for their young. Trust me, they didn't give up that seat on the board or major TV series for little Joshua to play the innkeeper's brother in a Gap polo neck. "A sheep was perfect for him last year," they cry. "But this Christmas we really feel he could tackle something a little more challenging." As the three wise men, a wispy red-haired boy propelled by two little girls, walk across the stage with their presents for the baby Jesus, the hall door opens behind us with a treacherous squeal. 100 pairs of eyes swivel round to see a red-faced woman with a Tesco's carrier bag and a briefcase. Looks like Amy Redmond's mum. As she edges, cringing and apologetic, into the back row of seats, Alexandra Law shushes her noisily. My instinctive sympathy for this fellow creature is outweighed almost immediately by an ugly swelling of gratitude that, thanks to her, I am no longer the last to arrive. I don't want other working mothers to suffer unduly. Truly, I don't. I just need to know we're all screwing up about the same amount. Up on stage, a wobbly wail of recorders heralds the final carol. My angel is third from the left in the back row. On this big occasion, Emily has the same inky-eyed concentration, the same quizzical pucker of the brow she had coming out of the womb. I remember she looked round the delivery room for a couple of minutes, as if to say, "No, don't tell me. I'll get it in a minute." This afternoon, flanked by fidgety boys, one of whom plainly needs the loo, my girl sings the carol without faltering over any of the words, and I feel a knock of pride in my ribcage. Why are infants performing Away in a Manger in a headlong rush so much more affecting than the entire in-tune King's College choir? I dig down into a bosky corner of my coat pocket and find a hanky. 3:41 p.m. At the festive refreshments, there are a handful of fathers hiding behind video cameras, but the hall is a swarm with mothers, moths fluttering round the little lights of their lives. At school functions, other women always look like real mothers to me. I never feel I'm old enough for that title, or sufficiently well qualified. I can feel my body adopting exaggerated maternal gestures like a mime artist. The evidence that I am a mother, though, is holding tightly onto my left hand and insisting that I wear her halo in my hair. Emily is clearly relieved and grateful that Mummy made it. Last year I had to drop out at the last minute when deal negotiations hit a critical phase.